You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
I don't know what you think of pastors, but like you, I'm a little bit of a mess. A few weeks ago, a friend of mine asked me how I was doing, and I told him, I'm doing great. Like, I feel more energy and joy than I've felt in a long time. And that was an honest answer. And then yesterday, another friend asked me the exact same question, and I said, I'm just trying to keep my head above water here, you know. It's just been a few weeks. Life's up and down like that, isn't it? It's a confusing world that we live in. Because on one hand, there are a lot of good things, aren't there? Laughter, friends, beauty, tacos, adventure. But even with all those good things, even if you have them all, there's still something inside all of us that thinks we're still missing something. And at the same time, alongside all the good things, there are so many bad things, aren't there? Grief, sickness, pain, conflict, loss. We could go on. And Ecclesiastes will do just that. We all know deep down that there's something wrong in this world. And more than that, we can't fix it. That's why when people ask you, how are you doing? It's like, well, that's kind of a complicated question, isn't it? I don't know. Fine, I guess. Life is full of complexity and tension. And some of us try to avoid the tension by constructing a bubble of positivity and busyness. And some of us can't avoid it. And in fact, we become overwhelmed by it. And we give our hearts over to despair and anxiety. And truthfully, most of us probably just kind of bounce back between these two extremes. Well, there's got to be more than life to life than just managing the swings, right? So here's the question. How can we live in this tension that is very real, but at the same time have real joy and hope? To put it another way, how can we find God in this fallen world? And to answer that question, we're going to spend 6 weeks in the book of Ecclesiastes. David Gibson says, this book is a meditation on what it means to be alive in a world that God created and called good, but that has also gone so very wrong. The main part of the book presents to us the teachings of a wise sage who has wrestled with all of this tension that we feel and has found some resolution. But it was a hard journey, and so he's not going to just give us the answer. He wants us to take the journey with him. And so he starts with a thesis. It's an alarming statement, and he knows deep down we don't believe him. And so then he begins to build out his argument, which develops throughout the book. But we'll get the gist of it, I think, here in the first chapter. And then finally, he doesn't give us all of the answers, but he points us to a way forward, a way that we can live with real joy and hope in the midst of real pain and struggle. All right, let's dive into chapter one. Here's the thesis statement, coming quick. Ecclesiastes 1:1. The words of the preacher. All right, so real quick, just give you a little layout of the land. Notice that there are two voices in the book of Ecclesiastes. Here, the author of the book is introducing you to the preacher, who I will call the teacher. He's more like a philosophy professor than he is a preacher, so I'm going to sit in the middle with teacher, all right? So the author is introducing us to the teacher. A lot of people think this is King Solomon. He is, at the very least, someone who's taking on the persona of King Solomon. This is a person who has seen it all and done it all, really, like really has. And now he's here to share with us what he's learned. Almost the entire book consists of the words of the teacher. And then at the end of chapter 12, the author comes back in and wraps things up and gives us his conclusion. But there's a long journey in between. All right, here's the teacher's opening statement, verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Maybe your translation says meaningless. Both of these get at something, but not quite the whole picture. The Hebrew word is the word hevel, or hevel. It's the key word in the book. It occurs 37 times in these 12 chapters, and it actually kind of has a range of meaning depending on the context in which it's being used. The literal meaning of the word hevel is smoke or vapor. And so let's think about that image for a minute to try to understand what the teacher is saying. Smoke is fleeting. Like it's here, and then just as quickly as it's here, it's gone. And he's saying our lives are like that. Psalm 144 says, man is like a breath. His days are like a passing shadow. So the brevity of life is a key theme, which means there's going to be a lot of talk about death. If you're uncomfortable with that, that's kind of the teacher's point. We've got to face that reality if we're going to understand the wisdom he has to offer. And so he'll tell you things like the wise and the fool both die and are both forgotten. In fact, he says, the wise man will work hard and then he will die, but he'll just have to leave all that he gained in life to someone else, and who knows how they're going to hit. Maybe they're a complete fool. That's hevel. Smoke is also elusive. It's real. You can see it, but as soon as you try to grab onto it, it just slips through your hands. There's nothing there. And many things in life are like that. We are constantly trying to take hold of people and things and pleasure and religion, thinking that these things are going to make our lives matter. But as soon as we get it in our grasp, it's gone. Nothing's there. So the teacher will say things like, he who loves money will never be satisfied with money. Some people have everything they could ever want, he says, except one very important thing, they don't have the ability to enjoy it. Oh, come on, that's hevel. The last meaning is this idea of mystery or paradox. Like, we look at the world and it's puzzling. We cannot explain everything we see, not even close. And there are a lot of times where what we're observing doesn't line up, or at least we don't know how to reconcile it with our theology, like what we read in the Bible. That's really difficult. It's enigmatic. So the teacher will say things like, we have this strong sense of justice, but you know what he's seen in the world? Bad things happen to really good people, and wicked people seem to just prosper with no consequence. Even in wisdom, he says, there's hevel. In chapter 8, verse 17, he says, however much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. That's hevel. Hevel is about life in a fallen world. And we're meant to ask the question, why is the world like this? And so when you dive into Ecclesiastes, particularly the first couple of chapters, there's all this language that is pointing us back to the creation story in Genesis, Genesis 1 through 3 especially. And so very quickly, in Genesis 1 and 2, God creates the world and calls it good. It's very good. Everything is in a state of peace and wholeness. In Genesis 3, Adam and Eve are deceived and tempted, and they fall into sin. They sin against God, and creation itself comes under the curse of sin. And so where there was peace and wholeness, now there is separation and loss, pain and conflict, thorns and thistles in the ground. That's why you don't like your job. It's hard. It's frustrating. Then in Genesis 4, another kind of fall story that we're not as familiar with, Adam and Eve have kids, and that's hevel. First, Eve has Cain. She conceives and bore a son named Cain. Now, the name Cain sounds like, there's a word play here, sounds like the Hebrew word for create. And so some scholars think that in Genesis 4:1, Eve is saying something like, look, I have created a man like God. The next verse, she bore a son named Abel. This is Cain's brother. Now, Abel literally is the Hebrew word hevel. And so there's this ominous foreshadowing going on in Genesis 4. Abel is the one who does what is right in the sight of the Lord, but then dies an untimely death in the hands of his angry brother. That is Hevel. We will come back to the Genesis story, but I want you to see that the teacher's pointing us to these things to tell us that the reason the world is like this is because it's corrupted by sin. And further, because we have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, we can't fix it. Ecclesiastes 1:15. I'm going to jump around a little bit. Stay with me here. But in 1:15, this is what the teacher says. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What's lacking can't be counted. Eric Ortlund says, so think of it like a puzzle. All the pieces are like jumbled up on the table. And what he's saying is, if that's the case, then we don't have all the pieces we need to put the whole picture together. And more than that, we don't have a clue even as to what pieces we're missing. There's just nothing we can do about it. We can't save ourselves. So the teacher wants us to take an honest look at the world to prove this point so that we feel it in our gut. And the point is, we're not in control. We want to be really bad, but we're not. Like Adam and Eve, we're constantly trying to take control of our lives. And like Adam and Eve, our best efforts turn into Hevel. The bubble of positivity and busyness, that's about doubling down on control. That's about shrinking our world to something that's manageable so we can protect our hearts from the Hevel of the world. Despair and anxiety is about feeling like you have lost all control and letting the Hevel rule your heart. The way of wisdom that Ecclesiastes gives us is instead to reorient ourselves as creatures dependent on the Creator. Craig Bartholomew says in his commentary, to find truth or meaning, we must start with God, not within creation. And he goes on to say, as in Genesis 2 and 3, what sets the world adrift is human desire for autonomy and to play God rather than embracing one's creatureliness. That's what the teacher wants us to embrace. Because we're creatures and not gods, then we can admit our limitations. And because we have a creator, we don't have to give our hearts over to Hevel. We can let him rule our hearts in the midst of Hevel. Now, here's what I know about you, at least some of you. You're ambitious. You got a lot of life out there in front of you, and you're like, yeah, okay, I get it. There's some Hevel out there, but not everything is full of Hevel. You're out there doing good stuff. You're making a name for yourself. You're moving up the ladder. You're doing awesome. You are awesome. You do you. I know that sounds silly to say up here, but out there, in the world full of Hevel, it's like, yeah, that's true. I am something. I'm making a difference. And the teacher's like, look, I get it. I know you don't believe me. I know you don't feel helpless. That's why there's 12 chapters. He's gonna argue it all the way through. And he starts his argument in verse 3 with a question. All right, so let's look at the question. First, he says, everything's Hevel. Verse 3, for what does a man gain by all his toil under the sun? That question might sound familiar to you. Because when Jesus, now you don't often think of Jesus as a wise sage, but he certainly is. Right? He said something better than Solomon has come, and he's talking about himself. Paul said all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge dwell in him bodily. All right, so when the wise sage Jesus came on the scene and he looked around at all the people bustling about, trying to make a name for themselves, you know what he said? Man, what does it gain? What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? See, he's He's building on the teacher's question. What does a man gain by all his toil with which he toils under the sun? The teacher is saying, think about your life. Think about the people around you. Think about how busy and stressed we all are. Think about all the things that people accumulate, all the experiences they have. Consider all the money and success just in this room, and just step back and ask yourself, does any of it provide lasting meaning? Does any of it prove to be an advantage in the end? No, the wise and the fool both die and are forgotten. Hevel is about life in a fallen world. Gain, which is a word we're going to see throughout, is about the fallen human condition. We think that if we can just gain, get enough knowledge or power or success, we can make our lives matter. Think of Adam and Eve in the garden. They had Eden, which is to say, they had God. Yet, they bought the lie that something was missing. There was something more out there than if they could just get that, then life would be okay. They just need to take hold of it. So the language in Genesis 3 is they saw, they took, they ate. All right, listen, Genesis 3, 6. When the woman saw that the tree it was good for food, it was a delight to the eyes, the tree was desired to make one wise. When she saw that, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave to her husband who was with her, and he ate. This is the wisdom of the world. Life is what you make it. If something out there looks good to you, don't let people hold you back. Go get it. Take hold of it. That's what they did, but what did they gain? Nothing. In fact, they suffered great loss. In Genesis 4, same thing. Eve put her hope for meaning, tried to secure her place in this world in her son Cain, and that too ended in great loss. To be clear, most of the things that we're chasing in the world are actually good things. They just can't give us meaning. They can't save us. Here's what Zach Eswine says. Whether we move or stay, spend or save, nothing and no one can make our lives pay off or yield the return for which we hope. For all of its beauty and dignity, the earth simply does not possess this ability. We refuse to believe this, he says. So the preacher uses the rest of the chapter to prove the point. All right, so in verses 4 through 9, we get a poem. Isn't that great? You get these big existential philosophical questions, and it's like, well, here's a poem. All right, he's not a math professor. He's a philosophy professor. Verse 4. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. There's a contrast between the relative permanence of the earth and the smallness and brevity of our lives. We come and go. How many of you know the names of your great-great-grandparents? Yeah. They were probably great. They came and went. You don't even know their names. A generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around it goes, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. That's weird, right? Water just constantly going in there, never fills up. And the rivers keep running. There they flow again. See, there's also here a comparison that has to do with the monotony of life. The sun rises and sets, and every day it's the same. Nothing changes. The wind runs on its circle and runs, comes back around. The rivers dump the water into the ocean. The water just evaporates, gets dumped back into the rivers, and the rivers run it back into the ocean, and that just goes on and on. Nothing ever changes. From the perspective of creation, he's saying, if the history of creation, doing all of its stuff, doesn't really produce any permanent change, what makes us think that our 70 years of hustle is going to? That's Hevel. We're basically building sandcastles on the beach. They're real. It's good work. They might even be really impressive. But the poem is saying, yeah, but tide is coming. Soon all this toil will be erased and forgotten. No one will know how great of a sandcastle builder you were. Verse 8, he goes on, more poem. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot even utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it said, see, this is new? It's already been in the ages before us. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. The search for meaning in this world under the sun is just endless. I mean, will there ever be enough likes? Like, seriously, will you get to the place with social media where you're like, you know what, I've reached all the likes that I want. I got so many likes today, I think I'm done with it. My cup is full. No, in fact, the more likes you get, the more you want to post. Will you ever get to the place where you're like, you know, I don't think I want to travel anymore. I'm really satisfied with all that I've seen. On Spotify, there are 70 million songs. Like, they're just a click away. You can listen to any of them. Yet, every Friday morning, almost the first thing I do when I get up is I look for the new releases because I'm hoping to discover new music. I have 70 million songs. They're not enough. Our quest for experiences and novelty and accomplishment is all chasing the wind. Every time you think you've got it, it just slips through your hands. That's why when Jesus comes along, he offers this wisdom. Don't gather up treasures for yourself on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. In other words, where they're subject to Hevel. Instead, lay up treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, or where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be also. Where is your treasure? One of my favorite novels, and it's not hard to say that because I've only read a few, but my favorite of the few is called Lonesome Dove. I love Lonesome Dove. And I read it a couple summers ago, and one of the things I just realized was almost every character in the story is just longing for something else, somewhere else. Almost all of them. So if Gus could just get back to that sunny hillside with Clara, then he wouldn't have any regrets in life. If Woodrow could just make this one last cattle drive to Montana, then he won't be so restless with the world. If Newt could just get the truth about his life, he wouldn't be so lost. If Dish could just get Lorena's love, then he would be happy. And the most obvious example of longing is Lorena. If she could just get to San Francisco, then life under the sun would be fine. Now, she has never been to San Francisco. She doesn't know anything about San Francisco, and that's the allure. As far as she knows, it's just like she imagines it. Maybe my favorite line in the book is a conversation between Gus and Lorena. Lorena's always talking about San Francisco, and Gus is patient with her, but finally, Gus says this, "Lori, darling, life in San Francisco, you see, is still just life." If you want any one thing too badly, it's likely to turn out to be a disappointment. The only healthy way to live life is to learn to like all the little everyday things. Wow, Gus is getting real close to the teacher's wisdom in Ecclesiastes. Close. Let me ask you, what's your San Francisco? It might be a literal new place. I often dream of moving to a small town because, you know, in a small town, there won't be any more problems. I was talking with a friend of mine who's a pastor in Brady, Texas, grew up there. Like his elementary school teachers go to his church now, you know. And so church is the town, it's everything. And he was like, hey, I assure you, more problems somehow with less people. He burst that bubble real quick. Maybe your San Francisco is a relationship or a new house or a new job, a new church, maybe. It is for her. That's the fundamental deception at work in our world. You're missing something, and it's out there. And if you could just go get it, if you could find it, get that new thing, then life will be okay. The truth is, life with all those things is still just life. So where does that leave us? Back to the original question. How do we find real joy and hope in the midst of real pain and confusion? The fullness of that answer will come in the weeks as we look through this book, but the teacher points us a way forward. Chapter 1 ends with this statement, verse 18. In much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. The more you learn, the more complex the world becomes, doesn't it? The more you gain, the greater that ache of emptiness is in your soul. That's the nature of life under the sun. We're creatures, not gods. We can't save ourselves. And if we let that sink in, that will bring us finally to the place where the teacher is trying to take it, which is a place of humility. And from that place, then we'll have the wisdom to look beyond the sun. That's what he's trying to point us to, a God who is in control and not subject to hell. A God who will bring every deed into judgment, every secret thing, whether good or evil. That brings real hope in a world of hell. That's not all Ecclesiastes has to say about God, but it is the starting point. It's the foundation of our trust in him. He's in control, and we're not. When the good creation fell under the curse of sin, God let it go on. He let it continue. Not as so to abandon it, but to redeem it. At just the right time, he sent his son into the world. Jesus took on flesh and dwelt among us. He saw the world just as it is, and he wept. He saw people hustling about, trying to make a name for themselves and get ahead, and he's like, hey, just so you know, the first will be last, the last will be first. He confronted over and over our shallow spirituality and all of our false hopes. Jesus was honest with us. He said, in this world, you're going to have trouble. There's hell. See, that's the realism of the teacher, isn't it? But then, right after that, he said something that the teacher couldn't say. He said, but take heart. I've overcome the world. Jesus didn't just observe the hell. He took all the hell of the world into himself on the cross. Is there anything more hell than the cross? The only righteous one suffers and dies in the place of the unrighteous? The cross of Jesus doesn't make any sense unless God is up to something that we can't see. like resurrection. You see, the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus shows us that God is at work in this world in ways that we don't see and can't predict. And so what's weird is our natural response to Hevel is to doubt God. Why is that? Given our serious limitations, seems like the reasonable thing to do would be to doubt ourselves and trust God. Rather than trying to protect our hearts from the Hevel of the world, rather than giving our hearts over to despair and anxiety, what would keep us today? What would be one good reason not to give our hearts to God? As we come to the communion table, I want you to listen to what Jesus said when he introduced this meal. You've probably heard it before, but listen afresh. Now, as they were eating, Jesus took bread, and after blessing it, he broke it and gave it to the disciples, and he said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And he took a cup, and when he'd given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." This is where we find God. Not by seeing and taking and eating all that we see under the sun, that's Hevel, but by seeing Jesus offered up for you, body and blood. Seeing what he has done for you and taking and eating. That's the life you're looking for. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.